everybody, and welcome to From Here With a View, a We Are the Seeds Philadelphia podcast. I am Tylin Ogoyo, and I am your host today. Today, we have a very special guest, Anthony Guzman, who is an enrolled member of the Northern Ute Tribe and the Director of Community Wellness Native American Health Center in Oakland, California. He is responsible for the strategic planning and administration of a multi-site program operating in San Francisco, Oakland, and Richmond that provides culturally sensitive and supportive community programs. Anthony oversees the center's social determinants of health programs, which include social service programming for youth and adults, cultural programming, health education, system navigation, coordination services, and HIV/AIDS prevention and care. Services are rooted in a holistic provision model that integrates prevention, community engagement, cultural competence, and provides linkages to other treatment services. Welcome, Anthony. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I don't think I wrote that bio, but that was great. That was fantastic to learn that all about me.
Good explanation?
Yeah, it's definitely work heavy, but yeah, that's what I do for work anyway.
Well, going through your entire career, it seems like you've had a diversity of experiences and have traveled quite a bit. And so I guess we can start by, you know, if you could share how you got started in this work.
You know, I came into social work definitely on accident. You know, education was by accident. Education really started off with kind of when my grandmother passed away. She was the person who completely believed in me, no matter how ridiculously, you know, troublesome I was. And that has a lot to do with, I think, a lot of problems that many of our youth face today and in the past, but, you know, issues of identity, having young parents, marginalization, lack of services, you know, growing up in communities that have a lot of violence and drug addiction and suicide. You know, I'm a product of that. I think a lot of our indigenous communities have heard that story over, you know, many and many times. But one of the things that my grandmother just always really impressed upon me was to graduate from high school. And I was, by the time I had turned, you know, 17 and 18 years old, I was out of high school. I was being very, you know, I was using a lot of alcohol and drugs and just being wild and being foolish. And when she passed away, I was very ashamed of myself, you know, that I couldn't fulfill a very simple task, which was to finish high school for the person that I knew, without question, loved me unconditionally. And so I made it a point to go back to and get my high school diploma. And I got that at Riverside Indian School in Anadarko, Oklahoma. And that was the beginning of my educational career path. You know, I think once I got that diploma, I realized that, you know, I could achieve something, and that it was a whirlwind after that. You know, I got very fortunate and found that I could, you know, run cross country, and that got me into Haskell Indian Nations University, and I ran cross country there. I got kicked off the team the first semester in for partying and, you know, just being a knucklehead. But I saw something there, which was I knew what was waiting for me back home on my reservation, and I didn't want to fail, and I liked it, you know. And honestly, what I liked was I got introduced to nightlife and music and something that wasn't at home. You know, I remember the first time I walked into a jazz club, smoky jazz club. You know, I was the only light-skinned person in there. It was a black jazz club. Everybody was dressed to the nines. And, you know, I was just like, and I heard, you know, the guy, the bouncer almost did not let me in. He's like, no, you can't come in here. I'm like, why? He's like, man, you can't come in here. You got a skateboard. You look like a, you know, little punk kid. And I was like, come on, man. I begged my way. And he finally let me in. And I remember going in there. And even the people that were in there looking at me were like, what are you doing in here? So I pulled up to the bar. And, you know, even the bartender gave me a look. But then as soon as that happened, a piano started. And this sultry, wonderful voice just started singing this interlude to music. And then, and at that point, no one could care less about me. And I just disappeared into the crowd and sat there and watched my first, you know, jazz by Black folks in Lawrence, Kansas. And I was like, wow, I'm never going home. And at that time, I got opportunities to listen to, you know, all kinds of music, from hip hop to rock to reggae to jazz to everything you could possibly imagine. I fell in love with art, you know, the art in the way, like, just I just see life as an art form, you know. And so I just, that was the beginning. I went, you know, graduated from Haskell, went to the University of Utah, and kind of fell into social work by accident. A man named Dan Edwards is the individual who pulled me into the social work program, because I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And, you know, social work wasn't something that I ever saw as something that helped the community. I saw social work as something that took children away and diagnosed people, told them they were crazy, or, you know. So even when I told people I was going into the field of social work, it was because, you know, they made fun of me, like, oh, you're going to take away your kids, or you're going to tell me I'm crazy, or do you want to talk me off the edge? They, you know, they'd say funny things like that, but I got it. You know, I got thick skin. I grew up in a rowdy community. And so, but I fell into social work a little bit on accident, but I had a little bit of inkling from a few key individuals in my life, because they saw that I had an inclination towards talking to people and being a very social person. Well, that's how I got into the work. And, you know, I've kind of moved around quite a bit ever since.
Wow, what a journey. That's incredible. And it seems like the music was so transformative for you, and that it was kind of how one thing led you to another. It's just so fascinating. You mentioned something about you being comfortable talking with people. And with your upbringing and everything you've seen in your community, you know, and that kind of tension with social workers, what was it that grabbed you and pulled you in and said, okay, I can flip this? It's always been negative connotation. This has been something that we don't accept in our communities, because it's always been traumatic for us, right? We've had generations of trauma with outsiders coming in and trying to. What gave you the idea that you could, as a Native person, join this field and make a difference?
There's two things. One of them, it started off very self-serving. You know, I was like, what will keep me in the street? I'm a skateboarder. I've been a skateboarder since I was a kid. Back in the day, skateboarding wasn't seen as this family-friendly thing. It was like punk rockers and the queer kids and the outcasts. So I like to say that, you know, skateboarders accepted people and were, you know, woke before woke was even a thing. Like, as long as you skated and you had your own style, that's all that mattered. You know, I'm 44 years old, I'm 45, I still skate to this very day. So I, you know, and being a skateboarder was the intersection of graffiti, hip hop, break dancing, punk rock music, hip hop music, you name it, anything that was in the street, skateboarding made that connection. And I think oftentimes people don't realize how much skateboarding has impacted popular culture through fashion, through music, through videography and cinema. Like, I think every aspect of popular culture has bitten off of skateboarding from the very beginning. You know, and being around like homeless people and drug addicts and gangbangers and all of that, I you know, like, what's going to keep me in the street but out of trouble? And it was always skateboarding. But then when I got older, I'm like, social work. Social work will allow me to stay in the street. And it did. You know, when I worked in Salt Lake City, I remember when my first real social work job, I worked at a homeless shelter in downtown Salt Lake City. And, you know, I remember after like a year or two, I was working there, and I, you know, I'd go downtown with my family or on a date or with, you know, just friends coming in from town. And I have all kinds of homeless people just being like, hey, what's up, Anthony? What's going on, man? It's good to see you. Like, but they all showed me love, man. They were like, what's up, Anthony? I'll see you next week. Or, hey, it's good to see you. And even my friends or my colleagues at where I work were like, man, you just seem to like, you seem to like have fun with this. I'm like, yeah, when I see these folks that are homeless or that are marginalized or that are suffering from mental health issues, they remind me of people that I grew up with. And so I don't judge them. I don't have this negative connotation towards people that are suffering or that are vulnerable, because I was one of those people too. I know how easily it could be for me to be in their situation. And so it was just a natural fit for me. And I've ran with it ever since. Sometimes it doesn't feel like work. The administrative portion feels like work, but the work with the people, that's not, that in itself is an art form.
So after you finished school, what was your first job and introduction into doing it professionally?
I was a case manager at the Road Home shelter in downtown Salt Lake. And then after I went back and got my master's degree, my first position was funny. I became a high school vice principal on my reservation for the Uinta River High School. So I became a vice principal, which was really, that was funny. I was like, wow, I'm a vice principal. And so I did that for a year, but things really didn't work out so well back home. I was in a relationship with my partner at that time, and we moved home and res life took over, and our relationship just completely fell apart, which in over a period of like a year, not even a year. And that just, really, even when I think back on it, really kind of reflects and shows me, how devastating it can be to live in communities that are suffering from so much trauma, often negativity. And I'm not saying that reservation life is all gloom and doom, because it's not, but there are the challenges out there, and if people aren't prepared for that, it can really do a number on not only relationships, but just, health. And so I didn't stay there for very long. And within a year, I had moved. I had to get out of there. I just knew it wasn't healthy for me there. And I moved to the Bay Area and became a clinician at a residential treatment facility at the Friendship House in San Francisco. And I worked at night at the after school program for Native youth in Oakland called American Indian Child Resource Center. And I did that for 5 years straight, 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. in San Francisco. And then I'd get on the train, shoot back to Oakland, and do 5 p.m. to 7 or 8 with the youth. I did that 5 years straight for that bout. But that was kind of my first real professional gig. I really cut my teeth with alcohol and drug. And that was something that I knew a lot about as well, because it was a large part of my life. Abusing, and kind of being around drugs and alcohol most of my younger years. So that was my first foray into my postgraduate degree.
And how long did you stay in the Bay Area? Because at some point you moved back home again.
Yeah, I was out here for 5 years, and then but I would say 2007 to 2011, and then I moved back home, and I was there for 7 years, I believe, on back in Fort Duchesne, the res that I grew up, the UNO reservation, and ran the outpatient alcohol and drug program for 7 years. And then from there, Salt Lake City, moved around. And in 2020, I got a opportunity to come back to the Bay Area, and I am now working at the Native American Health Center. As my most recent title is the Chief Cultural Officer, which is a very interesting title, but it's an emerging position that's coming up in urban organizations across the country, because the idea is this: if you're an urban organization and you say that culture is central to your mission and to your services, then put it at the table. Don't put it at a director position, a manager's position. Bring it to the highest levels of the organizations to ensure that not only does the position have a voice, when it comes to finances, when it comes to, service delivery, in every aspect of when big projects of building development, that there's a cultural voice at all times at the table, and it will always be there. So not only is it my organization, but many organizations across the country are starting to realize like this is something that we need to do in order to make sure that our organizations stick to the ancestral knowledge and wisdom that's kept us alive and thriving here in 2022.
That's incredible. And I know that you've been at the helm of a lot of those types of initiatives, and you've been really an advocate pushing so hard for it over the years. How have you seen it change in terms of like funders and and the people around you being receptive to everything that you've just described?
I think right now is one of those flashpoints in history. I think our, you know, the folks before us went through it during the occupation of Alcatraz. During that time was a fascinating time, but it was before my time, and you could see where all things indigenous, you know, land, you know, making sure that land conservation was being recognized, that tribal rights and hunting rights and sovereignty and social ills and issues were being addressed, you know, because it was right out there in on a platform where everybody could see, you know, and hear about those things on a level. You know, you had politicians talking about things, you had personalities talking about those things that were, you know, either musicians or actors and stars in Hollywood were seeking that not only enlightenment, but also recognize that there was true value in what indigenous thought and philosophy meant to the world. And I think that kind of, you know, it went through a wave and it faded a little bit, but then we saw DAPL happen. And then we started to see movement in people being elected officials. I mean, the biggest one we can think of is Deb Haaland. But, you know, we have so many Indigenous people now being able to voice their things over social media in a way that wasn't ever able to happen before. And so now our thoughts, our ideas, our prayers, you know, all of those things are now being on the forefront, and it's really amazing. And I don't think it's a fad. I think now it's almost like the world needs Indigenous people's thoughts and understandings of how to make a society more healthy. And so people are really craving that. But I don't think it's going to fade, because now there's too much of a platform to be ignored. And so I think it's been very embraced. You know, just to look at San Francisco, what they've done in order to, you know, there's this interesting phenomenon that happens across the country. It's been happening for a long time, you know, numerical genocide, and being able to look at data and numbers to kind of eradicate natives is always been there. I mean, just think about, you know, having a blood quantum, for instance. But then also when we think about, you know, when you go and check a box on a medical form, and you put American Indian and Latino, or an American Indian white, or American Indian and something else, oftentimes the evaluators or the statisticians will put other, or not even put you down as, you know, put you down as white or African American, which then diminishes the number of Indigenous people in cities and places, which can then say, oh, well, there's only, you know, 200 natives in Philadelphia, or there's only, you know, 150 natives in, you know, these different cities in San Francisco, when in reality, you know, we have very diverse, you know, community members. I mean, we have kids in East Oakland and all over the country that are French and Polynesian and Lakota and Apache. You know, are they going to put that on a form? And so we're, you know, and how do you count that? And so now we're starting to realize, like, no, you know, we are all of those things, and we need, you know, people to be recognized as Native and Indigenous if they mark it, and those numbers will go up drastically, so that resources are available, education, housing, job and resource training, all of these programs that were overlooked for so long because they're saying, well, there's no natives here, we don't see them in the numbers. Well, there was a reason for that, because oftentimes it was the ignorance of data collection. And so now that, you know, I got to say, because I'm in the Bay, San Francisco has really made strong efforts to say, you know what, we were wrong, and we're sorry for that, and we want to ensure that that doesn't happen again. So they've done a total transformation, and Oakland as well is saying, you know what, we're going to do a better job at identifying Indigenous populations in our community and ensure that they get the support and the resources they need to thrive. And so I think that's going to continue. I don't think it's something that's just going to go away. I think it's going to continue to grow, and I hope so.
Yeah, I agree. We're not going anywhere. And I think it's great. And there definitely has been a shift since social media and since we've had access to tell our own stories. And I want to go back, because the way we met was you called me up and asked me to, you were working at Fort Duchesne at the time, and you asked me to come in as an artist and do do a photography project for...
It was called Fancy Shawls, and then the subtitle was Women's Wellness Week.
Yes, and it was such a fantastic experience. I think I came a few years in a row, and we did photography project, video, and a lot of incredible work together over several days. But what I thought was really interesting about working with you, and we had filmed some video of you at the time talking about just the holistic approach that you had. I mean, you're an artist yourself. You've always been an advocate of artists, and you always wanted to bring in artists from different areas to be able to share, you know, with your community. Talk more about that. Talk more about why you do that. Why do you think that that's important?
You know, I kind of said it early on. I think life is an art form, you know, and I think that art, you know, Douglas Miles is a mentor of mine. And he, in an interview, he said something, it spoke to me because I saw it as true. And I'm like, that makes sense to me, you know. But, you know, you look at our ancestors and with beadwork and teepees and you know, the regalia that they have. I mean, those are things that people put in museums to look at as beautiful artwork. And it's like, well, not for us, it was just our clothes. You know, it was, you know, pottery was something that we used for, you know, carrying water, or, you know, we talked about the cradle board, which my tribe uses too. It's like, those are things that people see as artwork, but those were just like everyday things that we use, you know? So you can see where art and life are inseparable. I see the same thing. Like, so when I became a social worker, I was like, you know, I'm an artist, you know, I don't say that in the most heavy way, because I have artist friends, that's what they do for their lives. You know, I'm like, and I see the magnificent things that they produce, but I curate and I love art and it speaks to me, you know? And I thought, in my way, I am an artist, you know, I live the way I live my life. But I think if I had a right now in my life and over as a social worker, my palette was programming. So how do I incorporate an artistic creative spin on paradigms? You know, whether it's mental health, violence prevention, food insecurity, like I can figure out a way to incorporate art into that to make it more engaging so that people will lean into it and to make it so that there's a creative energy that attracts people. Because when something's beautiful, people are attracted to it. So why not? You know, like if I have a hat, I'm not just going to leave it the way that I bought it. I'm going to flare it out a little bit, put my own spin on it. You know, if I buy something, or I even, you know, skateboarders, they'll buy a piece of grip tape and they'll put it on top of their board and they'll paint it, you know, spice it up, trick it out, you know? And I think that's, again, that's just kind of the way that I see the world. You know, I see, you know, even my hair, you know, I've been coroning my hair since I had long hair. I love it. You know, many of my braiders were from all over the world, Sierra Leone, Botswana, you know, obviously from the States, but a lot of African braiders, some Latino braiders. And so just everything that I, you know, even down to my body, I mean, I'm pretty covered with tattoos, you know, so everything and parts of my life, I just feel like it's art, you know? And so it's hard to separate that.
Yeah. And to the degree that you can talk about it, you also, it was really important for you to bring in a spiritual aspect into your work. And I know you can't talk about all of it, but can you talk about some of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very open about that, you know, and I think that ceremony in all of its forms, you know, is so crucial to the health of all the people, not only to the indigenous people, but as a native person. Those were the things that we did to not only heal ourselves, but to celebrate life and to express our love to each other. Yuroks, Karuks, Pomos, Ohlone, Sioux, Dene, Ute, Cheyenne, and list goes on. On the top, I can see all these different ceremonies that all the people have. And yes, they're different. The songs are different. The protocols are different. But being somebody that, you know, is of mixed ancestry, who grew up on the reservation, off the reservation, and having a strong identity, I really found that I was lucky enough to have teachers from all different nations. And what I started to realize is that the underlying principles and values of ceremonies is really what binds us together. You know, when I go into a brush dance or to a sun dance or to a sweat lodge or to a bear dance, they're different, but I feel something that's underlying that, and it's love. And it's that connection to honoring our ancestors, our children, and our elders. And that's the connection. When they say all my relations means all of my relations, not just, you know, the people that I surround myself with. It means everything that we're connected to. And I think that's the undercurrent of ceremony and culture of Indigenous people around the world. And it's something that's missing from society right now. That's why we see so much disconnection and animosity and people that are lost and frustrated, and they seek that through medication and through substance, where, you know, what people might be lacking oftentimes is a connection with other human beings, with the water, with the dirt, you know, with the sun. You know, during COVID, what did we find out? A large portion of our society was deficient in vitamin D, meaning they aren't going outside. They are staying inside. They are not getting sunshine. And we're so, you know, we're germaphobes now. And it's like, you know, kids used to go outside and put a stick in their mouth and, you know, do all kinds of, but now we're just so afraid. And I think I'm not, you know, by any means, I'm not saying to be dangerous and take risks. But I think, you know, I don't know if it's necessarily been the most healthiest thing for us to shelter ourselves from nature as we have in the modern world. So that's what I'm thinking now today.
So in the way that you work, and you seem to try to find a lot of balance and make sure that you're maintaining wellness for yourself, how long do you think that you can stay in this field doing the type of work that you're doing? Because it obviously is very intense, not just administratively, but it must be a lot every single day.
Yeah, it is. I'm a constant wreck, but you know, that's okay. I like I say, I signed up for this. You know, I think there's no illusions here. You know, you have to be honest with yourself. What kind of tolerance do you have for the grind? And if you have that tolerance, go for it. But in order to sustain, like you said, it's a great question because I hear it every day. But I think that you absolutely need to take care of yourself in so many ways. Physical activity, drinking water, eating a decent diet, surrounding yourself with positive folks. And sometimes that's hard depending on where we live and in our families, because we don't want to dismiss our families. Making sure that we are emotionally stable. And that's also difficult because that can be tied to housing. And sometimes if you're homeless or you're living couch to couch or you're living in a shelter and you don't have the resources to have housing stability, how can you be emotionally strong? You know, my family has mental health issues in it going on both sides. There's intergenerational, you know, mental health issues that have been handed down generation to generation. And being able to talk to somebody about that, being able to have a community learn how to be not so taboo about that, you know, talking about and finding support and having resources in communities. I was physically and sexually abused as a child. Thank God I went to the School of Social Work because it helped me understand how I could, you know, heal from those things. And through my healing, I was able to help other people heal. And in integrating ceremonial wisdom and knowledge into those things, you know, and all of our ceremonies, you know, have elements of these understandings and teachings in there. You know, I think that, you know, a Pomo relative named Rob shared with me the other day. It was like, you know, there were old time ceremonies before colonization and the devastation that came with the land being taken and the wars. The old time ceremonies were really focused on love and healing, you know. And then when the tragedies happened across the world, we ended up we created new ceremonies that were a response to trauma and tragedy. And now we're in a wonderful, wonderful place. All those things aren't gone, but American Indians today are thriving. American Indians today are doing well. We are in one of the most sober Native populations that they've had since they started counting this data. You know, we have a highly educated Native population. We have a population of folks that are doing very well. Now, don't get me wrong. There are people out there that are vulnerable and suffering. But if we look at the entirety, we're seeing Native excellence emerge, and it's an exciting time.
Thank you for bringing up all of those points. I think they're so important. And my final question to you, gosh, you've talked about so much, and we could talk for hours. Going forward, because you have so many projects on your plate, and not just for work and your career, but just you're a visionary, like you're always thinking ahead. You're always thinking about how things can be better. Maybe you can't pick just one, but what is your dream?
My dream is to one day write poetry, have my own, and create a reentry program that helps folks getting out of the prison system to become tree arborists. And those tree arborists will then cut trees and then use the firewood, use the wood to cure it, so that then they can give that wood to sweat lodges for free, all in any area that they're in. So whether it's, you know, whether it's in prisons where they oftentimes don't have access to regular wood, to the elder that has a sweat lodge in his backyard, to the treatment facility that has a sweat lodge there, to people who utilize wood as a resource for ceremony or for living. And then to tie that to my skateboard company, Resolution Skateboards. So, you know, I'm still tying skateboard and poetry and the wood together. And one day that would be my dream, is to be able to skateboard all day, write poetry all day, and then help people who came up the way that I did find an opportunity to take care of themselves and thrive. That's my dream.
That is fantastic. I love it. So can you share with our audience your website or anything that you'd love them to look up or how they can support?
I've been so overwhelmed with work that I don't get oftentimes to put the efforts into my own personal things. But I do have a Facebook page. Right now it's under Neola Redmoon and Anthony Guzman on Instagram. I think it's under The Last 99 Miles.
Yes.
You have a Twitter, and I think it's at That Northern U.
We can post those up.
I want to have a website. I've been so trying to get my website up because I've had products, but I'm even with that, like my product line, I just give it all away. I never made any money off my skateboard company or my stuff. I just give it away. I'm like, dang man, like I don't know if this business thing's my. I don't know. It still makes me feel good. It's like, mm-hmm. I guess they say, you know, When you're blessed, share the blessing. And that's, I guess that's kind of a motto that I live by.
Anthony, thank you so much for joining me today. I know you are absolutely so busy. And the fact that you took the time to speak with us, I'm really appreciative. And I'm just really appreciative for your friendship all these years.
Tyler Nimino, like I said, you know, when you called me up, I was like, you know, you've always been a dear friend. I know you've got a heart of gold. And again, you know, it's, you know, when it comes to being the person I'm trying to work to become, you know, being there for your friends is really important. So I do my best to be a good friend as well. So I appreciate you. And so absolutely, when you call up, I'm like, absolutely, I'll let me know the time and the place.
Yeah. And you were there. This has been From Here With A View, a We Are The Seeds Philadelphia podcast. I am your host, Tylin Aguayo. Please tune in for our next shows and check us out on podcast platforms everywhere. Thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful week. From Here With A View, a We Are The Seeds Philadelphia podcast is produced by Michelle St. John with music by Zachariah Julian and original logo art by Jason Wiesaw. This podcast is funded in part by Independence Public Media Foundation.